general, this kind of information is also applicable to many other pieces of the system. So in some form, it also applies if you want to contribute to the kernel and these kind of other fundamental packages which are coming to the system. So I have to apologize for the way it looks here. So this should not be the look which is on the screen, but it's very fragile. I don't want to touch the system yet anymore. Maybe the picture will disappear again. So we have to live with this. So as I said, this is a talk I've given a couple of years back at the conference in India. I think it's very well advised here as well. So let's get ahead of this. I have to apologize if I'm stumbling a bit because I haven't seen these slides in quite a while. So what is so? First, we have to define what is really meant with the basic runtime. If you take a look at the simply a schematic of the system of the computer system, it simply looks something like this. You have the hardware that's on one end, and you have the application at the other end. And to make actually program development scalable in one form or another, we don't want to have every application to know everything about the hardware. This was what we had back in the 60s, not anymore, fortunately. So we have a couple of standardized features of software in the middle. One is the kernel, which deals with all the hardware abstraction. And then on top of this, we have the basic runtime. The one piece of the basic runtime is C library on the Unix system. There are other parts, C++ library, you can imagine, and math library, and threat library, and all these kind of things make up the basic runtime. And this is usually the interface which is used when you are developing applications. So the applications themselves are using what is called an API, an application programming interface, which is provided by the basic runtime, sometimes by the kernel. And this part has the benefit that it's higher level than any of the other interfaces, and that specifically than the interface the kernel is provided. So you don't have to replicate that much code in your own application. So the second benefit, which this API's part, is they are actually portable among different operating systems. So if you develop your application in some form, you can probably run it with very little changes on another operating system because these APIs are standardized. There's a standard which we are trying to follow called POSIX, POSIX. And this standard is simply specifying most of the interfaces which are part of what we are defining as the basic runtime. Because this is a really, really big book. It's around 4,500 pages thick, and unfortunately I have to know about it. Everybody else who's actually contributing probably should also know about this thing. But let's go on. So why is the basic runtime special? First of all, it has many interfaces. And when I say many, I really mean many. We're talking thousands. The kernel itself has only a couple of hundred interfaces, which are the system calls. So in fact, on an architecture like x86-64, I think we are currently at 230 interfaces. The C library, and math library, web library, and so on, all together have probably 4,500 interfaces. All of them have to be kept up to date. So they are abstracting out things like the kernel interface, processor-specific interactions and so on, but most of them are geared towards the application developer itself. But as Tom said, they're coming from various different standards, like POSIX, also their operating system specific interfaces therein as well. This kind of thing is absolutely common in the IP software world. So one counter example, for instance, is the set of libraries called OpenSSL. These people who are maintaining these libraries, which you could also imagine are part of an extended basic runtime system. Unfortunately, the OpenSSL libraries are breaking compatibility of the API and API with every single version they're putting out, which is creating enormous headache. Imagine we are doing this for the C library, and every single program would have to be recompiled every time we are releasing a new version. It's simply not acceptable. So whenever we are doing changes to the C runtime, we have to completely maintain compatibility. So fortunately, what we have done at some point, very early on actually, with the development of GDC, is to invent a mechanism how we can both invent and implement new interfaces, which sometimes invalidate existing interfaces, but at the same time, we are maintaining compatibility. There is something in the implementation of the C library called symbol versioning. For those interested in this, you can look at my website. There's a documentation for that. And symbol versioning allows us to implement changes which would break the API, but at the same time keep old applications running. And this was one of the fundamental benefits of how we implemented GDC back then. So, but in general, everything is correct. Everything you correct implementation application will continue to work going forward and as it has been in the case in the past. And I say really every correct application, because there are some applications which are using interfaces in an incorrect way. They are using semantic of a function which is not country, and we have all the support in there for a long time now, probably going forward as well. The C++ standard is mostly implemented in a separate package called libstandard C++, which is part of the GCC package, but there's a lot of interaction necessary with the rest of the system, and GCC has quite a bit of influence in the actual implementation of the C++ standard as well, especially when it comes to the complex mechanisms like the implementation of exception handling and the interaction of the customers with things like dynamically loaded code and so on. So we have to pay attention to these details as well. Then there are various internet RFCs. RFC stands for Request for Comment. This is the way the internet is actually standardized and how it is developed. People are simply putting the text out in a certain form, submitting it to a standard body, and they are putting this then out as a text, as a document, which other people can comment on. If people are implementing it according to this, it becomes a de facto standard and is adopted into the mainstream and used for guideline as implementation for many of the operating systems out there. There's another level of potential conformance. Some of the RFCs have made that into actual standard forms, with something like TCP, UDP, and so on. Initially were RFCs, but they are now actual internet standards. But this is not absolutely so necessary. So the internet standards group is a really, really small group of documents. The RFC group is much larger. So I think we are now close to 6,000 RFCs, of which probably perhaps still 1,000 or something like this are relevant. And we have to pick quite a few of these RFCs to implement them, because some of them are actually documented in library interfaces. So one of the more famous ones is the RFCs, which is governing a function called getAddress. This function is not really well specified to the POSIX standard from which it originally comes. The POSIX standard has to be far too general to actually make it useful for the actual implementation of network functions, network standards. Instead, where we have to get the rest of the specification on our certain RFCs, and once we have done this in the past, as much as it is useful. One last standard which I want to mention in this context is called OpenMP. This is becoming more and more interesting and more important, because with the growing number of parallelism requirements for your programs because of the increased number of ports and sockets on the machines, we have to make parallel programming easier. And one way to actually do this is to use a programming technology called OpenMP Intersect. That's a publicly developed standard. And it makes parallel programming a lot easier than using threads or multi-process semantics in a direct form. OpenMP is a mechanism to annotate existing programming, that's actually the best way to actually get started doing this, because it requires little to no changes to the code. All the code which is has been annotated to use OpenMP is still usable with an ordinary C compiler without any change at all. So another thing which I already mentioned, which is very important to keep in mind when you are developing the basic runtime, is that every single change you are making, if you're introducing a bug in this kind of change, it can have immediately catastrophic consequences. If I'm making it a bug, if I'm introducing a bug and in the library, let's say an XML library or something like this, it will affect a couple of programs, but the most of the system will still continue to run. If, on the other hand, I'm introducing a bug in a component like kernel or the basic runtime, the entire system is going to drop down. Mm-hmm. That's the difference between programming of a normal application or library, which is an auxiliary library, which is not critical to the system, and actually changing parts of the system which are used by basically every single piece of code out there. So we have to be really, really careful. We cannot really make mistakes after releasing something. We have to test things really carefully, and we have to really vet the patches we are applying very carefully. So this is why it's actually pretty hard to get for an inexperienced programmer to get a patch accepted to the both the kernel or the C library or other product or across the component system. Because it is a matter of trust to some extent whether the maintainer of the package is actually trusting the person submitting the patch that they have tested and thought about the changes in a sufficient way to guarantee that there are no problems introduced. So if you want to contribute to something like the kernel or Zulab, you really have to earn the respect of the maintainers first before you can actually contribute something of significance of any size. It's actually also very hard to test the kind of changes, which makes the whole thing even worse. Because if you do something for the kernel or the library of any sort, the problem is that these components can be used in a wide variety of different scenarios. So the C library can be used in the web application, or it can be used in a high-performance computing application. And the requirements of these applications on the runtime are very, very different. They're using completely different code. And if you say, yeah, I tested something, well, you tested it perhaps in one of the scenarios, but it might create problems in another scenario. So it's a very hard thing to actually get right. So let's break down actually the various parts of the system which make up the basic runtime as I want to define it. We have the C library, the support library for the C compiler and C++ compiler followed with GCC. That component, it comes with the GCC compiler. It's not maintained by me, it's maintained by the compiler group. Then there's the C and math library. That's the part which I'm responsible for the last 15 years. The Greg library also comes from this. Then we have the open actually based on where the request comes from and where the actual physical memory is resided. These kind of things have severe impacts on the programming of the entire system, on the operating system, on the runtime libraries, and so on. So this kind of knowledge can definitely be used to improve the basic runtime in many ways. So if you have these kind of knowledge, well, you can apply it to things like, again, abstraction libraries for C++ and so on, the P library, but also to some extent the C library itself, which has some independence. On the higher level, there are very expected results there, basically. If you are have interested in things like algorithms and so on, which of course is very theoretical at some point, but they apply very well to some of the bigger problems which we have. We have bigger pieces of code in the entire runtime, so for instance, C++ libraries contain implementations of various types of searches, structures, and trees, and so on, and they can always help get need help for improving these kind of algorithms. And we have also every bigger piece of function which exists anywhere most probably has the need for better use of the resources which we have in the system. So for instance, the ML implementation could probably do away or can benefit from a better implementation of certain data structures we are using in common and so on. So this can help at all kinds of levels. And obviously the last thing which I have mentioned here is mathematical knowledge is also always necessary in one place. But this is necessary is the math library, obviously, which comes with the C library. And the math library is, well, somewhat okay nowadays, but there are lots of boundary cases which can really well use some tuning, some cleaning up, so that it's actually not behaving as badly as it does in the moment. For instance, we have a couple of functions in the math library, which the math library, by the way, is geared towards being perfectly accurate. But this means that in some boundary cases, function which should run, which should be finished, executed in a couple of hundreds of thousand cycles, might actually take seconds, so billions of cycles. This is because not only I spend the time on actually fixing these kind of things, but unless you are really a mathematician, and by that means a number theoretical mathematician, I'm not trusting myself doing this when I actually study it. So, and that's really stuff which is beyond the average person's grasp, and well, everybody who knows this kind of thing is certainly welcome to try their hands on improving the code. So optimizations which are possible, which people can do, are related to what I just mentioned to some extent. So CPU knowledge and cache knowledge, so CPU cache knowledge and stress memory utilization definitely needs improvement in most of the system. This also applies to not necessarily to the implementation of the various components, but simply helping the programmer write code, so helping the user of the library write code so that the code they are producing in their own application is using memory more efficiently. So this means that, for instance, that data structures we are constructing in the libraries and so on are laid out more efficiently, that we're working, for instance, memory instead of jumping randomly across memory, we're utilizing memory in sequential fashion, which is much faster. It's orders of magnitude faster than that, because random memory accesses are actually pretty slow when it comes to compared to sequential memory accesses. So this kind of thing always opens a lot of avenues for improvements. Then we have more stuff to do when it comes to support actual threat programming, logic programming, and so on. There are lots of different effects which normal fashion, in a normal environment, is to try to replicate the error conditions so that we can analyze the problem again and perhaps analyze it when running the debugger and things like that. But this is oftentimes really not possible. Oftentimes we don't know how we created the error. And then in the case of Red Hat being able to replicate what the customer has, sometimes it's completely impossible. Some of our customers are running our operating system, for instance, Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory in California. They have a machine which has 260,000 computers connected together. Maybe it has to do with running that many machines. We don't have such a computer in our lab. It's simply impossible.
So,
optimization for the string and memory functions. I have actually actually, so if a colleague of mine at Intel and I myself have done actually quite a bit of work in the last couple of months of this kind of thing for the Exodus 6 project and so on, but for many other processes, this is still something which is missing. The string function actually plays a very important role when it comes to the performance of the program itself. Any improvements in there can have measurable performance improvements on the entire system. So that's actually an order and item which can actually help quite a bit. Another thing which has long been on the radar is to do what is called sectionally ordering. So this simply means that the C library itself contains, as I mentioned already, thousands of interfaces, and currently the object files which are making up the library are more or less randomly ordered and put together into what is the shared object, or shared library. But this means that we most probably are increasing the amount of memory which has to be kept in caches unnecessarily, because there's code which is frequently used and code which is not frequently used in the same cache line, or at least in the same memory page. If we could reorder the memory to code so that all the frequently used code is kept together and the unfrequently used code is kept somewhere else, we are reducing the memory footprint and therefore also the effects which running the application has on the caches, and this might actually have significant improvements on the performance of the system as well. Other things, well, we don't have to talk about this anymore, that are actually done now, but there are other things to work on. One of the things is localization, and well, probably don't have to tell you here in Asia and so on, the world still, the Unicode is still very much US-centric. There are large parts of the world which are not yet really have their systems extended and adjusted so that you can use this using the localized interfaces. And it all starts at some point in the C library, the definition of the locales, which is the description of how actually a language, a country language combination looks like. So there are several countries which are not covered, and an easy way to actually get into the development of the systems. Last thing, map functions already mentioned. If you know about map, there's always room for improving the map function, come speed for performance reasons, or in some cases still for accuracy reasons. So both of these goals still apply, and there are always functions in there which can be optimized. So which brings us to the next topic, the thread library. The thread library has actually been re-implemented as to be optimized. One problem of the OpenView implementation, for instance, is that we have to better control how many threads are actually used in the implementation, in the program, in the process at any point in time. It might be not useful, so currently we are simply determining how many processes are dealt with this process and use this as a process. But there might be better measurements of this. Perhaps it's too, these are too many or too little threads. We need perhaps method to find out, do some profiling, implement better heuristics for this. Related to this is the fact that if you run more than one process using OpenMP at the same time on the same machine, both of these processes will think, I can use all the processes in the system. So if you have a four processor system and you start two OpenMP processes, both of them will use four threads and you're overtaxing the system because you have to schedule between these eight threads and have to schedule them on four processes. So of course, it would be better if the OpenMP implementation has a holistic view of the system and can find out how many other processes are there around which want to do this kind of work. Then the OpenMP implementations can amongst themselves coordinate and say, you automatically transparently use parallelism. This is implemented using OpenMP for chats creating parallelism on time. And this is certainly far from complete. So just to give an example, if we want to implement one of the functions which is part of the semantic process is the sort function. If you want to sort a large, really large array, we can do this in parallel in many things. So an algorithm like quicksort works by using the divide and conquer mechanism, which means we are sorting first this part of the structure, then we are sorting that other part, and then we are combining the results. By using by dividing this up, we are automatically generating the possibility for parallelism. We could put two threads to work at the same time, have one thread work in the one half and another thread the other half, and we are actually getting a significant speed up. And this is actually done in this parallel mode where we have, with the use of OpenMP, implemented these kind of mechanisms automatically. So we just have to select parallel mode and voila, we're getting the use of parallelism. But as I said, this is far from complete. Unfortunately, this would have to scratch from the list because C++ 2010 will not have concept in it. It was a nice pipe dream. The people making the standards, unfortunately, not following what I'm doing, so unfortunately, that is not there anymore. Another thing, the last thing for the C++ library side, our security features with Valve. We already have a limited support for a debug mode. In the C library, we have, I think, pretty much complete support for something like the secure mode, this debug mode, which detects and prevents most buffer overflows which arise from incorrect uses of the C library. This kind of thing is missing in some of the parts of the C++ standard library. There is limited support for this, but it is also probably too slow. The support in the C library, which we have in there, has almost no performance impact. And therefore, we are actually in at Red Hat for our enterprise distribution, not for the Fedora distribution, are always enabling this mode. It means that our programs, if there should be a bug in the program, will not have disastrous security effects. The program will just terminate instead of doing something evil. On the C++ side, we don't have this. The debug mode which we have is far happier, it has far more performance impact, and therefore researching can actually debug in security features which are relevant, which can find some of the problems and actually detect them and prevent them from being exploited. It's highly relevant. So, last things, what is always needed, and this is advice for everything, and that's usually a very good entry point for programmers who don't have yet that much experience and who have to make a name for themselves, that's write more test cases. As I said, many of these components are derived from or are based on standards, which I listed before, and the standards tell you exactly what the semantics is. Many of these semantical requirements don't have equivalent test cases in the appropriate test. documentation in bad English is better than having no documentation. So don't feel afraid to do this kind of things. So where to go to actually do this kind of things? I mainly talked about two components, which is the GLC, the C library, and the rest of the crowd of other libraries that are part of GCC. The GCC library has its home page here. GCC has its home page here. That, it's listing all the source code repositories, it's listing the mailing list, and all these kind of things. The back repository and back database are referenced there. That's the only place you have to go if you're interested in this kind of work. And well, I guess that if you really should show up and want to do some work, you always want to do it. So, thank you very much.
Correct that you have to have knowledge about the entire process. It
assumption of some sort, which can benefit of using parallel. I can write this using the normal pthread function library and so on, and can say I'm creating here two threads and I'm doing some work. Alright, this might work well if we know the machine is running two, has two processes and so on. But now what happens if you are calling this function from two threads at the same time? At this point, you have two calls of the function, each of them creating two threads. So you have a total of four threads. This might overuse your machine because it doesn't have that many things, many processes available. If instead you're using OpenMP to create a parallelism in the function, and then two threads are calling into the function which is using OpenMP, the OpenMP library will notice, oh, I only have two processes available, and it will not create any additional threads. So it will not overtext the machine. So OpenMP actually helps exactly the situation which you're worried about, which is not possible, not that easily possible, if you're using explicit threading. But I'm not saying it's optimal. It's definitely not an optimal way. And if you look at this, so I mentioned couple of things which we can do, and one of them is here a whole process view. That's the one thing, the big thing which is missing at the moment. If you have more than one process using OpenMP in the system, so process wise, not inside the process. If you have two processes, both using OpenMP, then you might still use too many threads for to use the machine efficiently. That's a big thing which can be helped. And there, if there are developers or researchers who are interested in actually doing this, yeah, the OpenMP library is very open. We can do a lot of work there. We have actually interfaces in the kernel. We can make them available in other libraries to get at information like what is the current load of the machine, what, how many processes do I have, and things like that. This kind of information we can make available to the OpenMP library so that if somebody wants to come up with heuristics, better heuristics to determine the number of threads you should use, it's very well doable. You can do that, just somebody has to do the work. It's a microphone coming.
Yeah, you see, there are some Cisco list file and some directory and in Lab C. You see. Well, I want to know, do you have any document to explain how to use the system of Cisco list file? I mean, just what kind of function should we use in this file? And other files like watch list and files.
Okay, I'm not sure I entirely understood this. You're talking, asking about the system calls?
Yes, Cisco list file.
Yeah.
What kind of function should the list use file?
Okay, the system calls themselves, I tried to answer your question, which I'm not sure is exactly the one you're asking. So the system call list is, of course, specified by the kernel, and in the C library, we have records for all the system calls which make sense to be used. Not all of them make actually sense to be exported from the C library. So, for instance, the write system call has an equivalent, but there's a system call called getTLD, which has no equivalent. This thing doesn't make any sense, so usually you don't need this, but they have a function called syscall in the GLC, in the C library, which allows you to call any system call. And so the only thing you have to know is which system calls are available on the system. That's maybe this is what you're asking about. That's something which is not discoverable from the outside. You have to execute the system call and see what the result is. If the result is an error which says there is no such system call, then you're out of luck. And you have to do something else. That's the only way that the way to proceed does it internally as well. specifically in the implementation of GLC, how these systems calls are done. Well, system call records are magic. So they appear out of the air. We are generating them on the fly. Well, you don't really have to understand how this works. So these functions are sometimes generated, as I said, as part of the configuration process of GFC. There's some scripts run, and they are generating a header file, or more correctly, a shell script, which by itself then is generated by generating makefile rules. And they are then, in turn, generating source code, which makes up system call records. So these kind of things are really, really magic. In the situations when you actually have a file which is named, received, from, or whatever, then this is only done if we actually need support at user level to actually use this system call. By default, we are not doing this at all. We don't have to. We just compile the system on the machine, which has sufficiently recent kernel headers, and everything works just like that. Only for some architectures you might actually for some system calls and some architectures you might need something special to be done, but in general you don't have to worry about this kind of thing. They get automatically generated these files. So if you want to port GFC to a new architecture, just try to compile it and you will see that wrappers for system calls like Drive get automatically generated. You don't have to worry about it. So receive from is another thing, but that's a special case. Depends on the architecture. So on x86, for instance, you need a special piece of code. On x64, you don't. There's no easy answer for this. It very depends very much on the system call, on the architecture.
Excuse me, I want to know, in GLMC, each agriculture has field named the worship, the Shire Level Worship Center.
Can you repeat that?
In each agriculture, the subfields named the worship center. The Shire Level Worship Center.
Shire Library Worship?
Yes. SHLIBS worship. I want to know what's mean, how to use it.
Oh, the versioning, simple versioning. Well, they I have a document on my website which is documenting this kind of thing. Exactly. So people.redhead.com/redhead has a document describing simple.